You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. We're talking today about the Santa Fe Opera. We've got an exciting program in store for you. We'll be back in just a half a minute. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Corey Ellison. She is dramaturg with the Santa Fe Opera, and we're here to talk about the upcoming season. Opening night is this coming Friday, June 28th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
It's great to have you. So there's five operas in the Santa Fe Opera this year, as there are every year, and we're going to talk about each one of them. Some of them are classics that have been here many times before. Some of them have never, one of them has never been here before, and one is a world premiere, so it's quite a variety.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about First of all, the role of dramaturg. This is a new position at the Santa Fe Opera. You're the first person to hold this. What does a dramaturg do?
Well, I wish I had a nickel for every time I got asked that question.
I'm sure.
Because basically nobody knows what a dramaturg does, but I'm here to tell you. So a dramaturg, a company dramaturg, would be sort of like a scholar in residence for an opera company, but somebody who applies their scholarship in an extremely practical way in service of the new productions, supporting the directors and designers and sometimes conductors with research and support in developing their concepts if they want. Also, Santa Fe has always had a heritage of putting on world premieres, but we've especially in the last couple of years and the coming years, we've made a big commitment to presenting, developing and presenting new works. So I work very closely with the composers and librettists of the new works, helping them to develop their stories into solid dramatic form.
Right.
And helping them to workshop the new works and so on. And then the other part of my job here is to take what I learn from those experiences, working with the directors and the composers and librettists, and what I learn in my research about the pieces, and be a resource, an information resource for the rest of the company, for all of my colleagues, so that messaging across the company is very on the same page, if you will.
So you have to be both very much a people person.
Oh, yeah.
And a scholar.
Uh-huh.
And this is the kind of work, I mean, dramaturgs, I imagine, don't go to dramaturgy school, but come from sort of eclectic backgrounds, and it's something you put together.
Oh, very much. You just told me my life story. Because actually, my college training was as a singer. And also, I had a concentration in theater arts. And my early career was as a singer.
Like opera-style singer?
Yeah, an opera singer. But I always found that I was equally interested in all of the things that went on around singing and performing. And that I always wanted to research the things I was doing and translate them and so on. And then a little later on, I came to find that that was really my niche, and I also felt that I could probably have a greater impact by doing this kind of work. So it was a little bit of a long trajectory, because there's not been a history of opera house dramaturgs in this country. So,
and there are more in Europe.
There are many. Yeah, it is originally a German tradition, and pretty much all of the German-speaking lands have them in their opera companies. In Germany, you can go to school and get a degree as an opera dramaturg.
Okay.
But it's a newer field here.
So let's talk about the different operas. And I thought we could go sort of in chronological order of the time that these operas mm-hmm. premiered, which would have us start with Mozart.
Yes.
Così fan tutte, mm-hmm. which is classic opera performed many, many times all over the world. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful, funny, and fun drama about this great question of whether women can be faithful.
Yes, it is. And it's because of that, you know, and the title literally means all women do that. So it would appear to put a very unfavorable spin on women's fidelity. But of course, nowadays, as we are with many pieces in the repertory, we're faced with challenges in our standard repertory because they come from different eras when people thought very differently about things like feminism and racism and so on. But they're great, great masterpieces. So we have to figure out how we're going to approach them today.
Well, this is an opera that apparently, correct me if I'm wrong here, but in its time, people accepted it and loved it, and then there were later periods where it was considered risque.
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, it premiered in 1790, the next to last year of Mozart's very short life. He died the next year at 35. And it was accepted, you know, it was sort of the tail end of the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment period, and Romanticism was rearing its head. And during that era, women were quite idealized. And so the Romantics didn't like Cosi very much, and they even went to the extreme of performing it to different librettos. Like they would put a completely different story and completely different words to it so that they could preserve the music.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, which is kind of crazy. But it was really in the 20th century that it really started to come back into the repertory. It's interesting because the Met didn't even do Cosi until 1922, whereas they did the other two Mozart da Ponte operas, Don Giovanni and Le Nozze di Figaro, very early on in their life in the Met. But it's really roared back during the 20th and the 21st century because it is so beautiful and it is so meaningful. I think in a lot of ways it's Mozart's most modern drama because it is very ambiguous and ambivalent, and it doesn't come to an easy pat conclusion.
Although everybody kind of lives happily ever after.
Well, no, I don't think so.
Really?
Well, after what they go through, I think it's impossible for them to live happily ever after.
Okay.
And I actually think that Mozart thought that too, because I sort of think there's a point in the second act where I think Mozart and Da Ponte sort of almost part ways because Da Ponte brings, you know, being a classicist, he does bring it to a very neat ending where there's a moral to the story and supposedly the two pairs of lovers are supposed to go back into their original configurations. But Mozart, once you hear the music of Fiordiligi and Ferrando in the second act, you realize that something really serious is going on. Those two have really fallen in love.
Let's back up just a moment because some of our listeners may not have seen the opera or
sure.
heard the music or anything. Da Ponte was the writer of the libretto.
Yes.
Mozart did the music.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it's about two pairs of fiancés.
Yes.
Two young women and their fiancés who are soldiers.
And the women are sisters.
Tell us what happens next.
Well, the soldiers, Ferrando and Guglielmo, have this friend who's quite a bit older, Don Alfonso, and he's kind of been around the block and he's pretty cynical. And he says to them, well, you think your fiancés are so faithful and so pure, but I bet I could prove to you that they would be unfaithful to you if they had the chance. And the guys say, oh, no way, never. So they make a bet. And the guys are sure they're going to win the bet, but it doesn't turn out quite that way. And so the opera is a series of tests of the fidelity of these women. And in the course of those tests, a lot about human nature is revealed.
And, I mean, the women, they're teenagers, right?
They are supposed to be teenagers, and we have to remember that.
Yeah.
You know, because it's quite different if you're talking about, you know, 30-somethings that are behaving this way. But they are supposed to be, like, late teenagers, and I think that's a good thing to keep in mind. And we have a very youthful cast here, too.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So they are tested, and they're really pushed quite far because, I mean, there's a couple of times where one of the, let's call them girls, young women, says, no, I will be faithful to my fiancé forever. And what happens is the two soldiers, pretend they're going off to war.
Yep.
And then go into disguise. And it's one of those things like in Shakespeare, it's like, you don't recognize them, really?
Yes. Well, that's where, you know, the suspension of disbelief comes in.
Right.
You know, and you have to figure that in opera, there's a basic suspension of disbelief in that you walk into an opera house, people are singing instead of talking.
Right.
So if we've accepted that much, why not improbabilities of plot?
Right. So one of the characters in this, besides the two pairs of lovers, is the maid, who's also continually going into disguise. And she's got a wonderful role.
Mm-hmm. She does. She's sort of, in a way, a double agent. Because actually, she is quite loyal to her the women that she serves, Fiordiligi and her younger sister, Dorabella. But Despina is of a lower class. She's of the serving class. And she's been around the block, too.
Right.
And she sort of, it's her feeling that men aren't faithful. You know, that these guys are going off to war. Don't expect them to be faithful to you. So why should you be faithful to them? So Don Alfonso enlists her in this plot to get the women to be unfaithful. But the detail that he does not tell her is that the suitors that are going to come and pursue Fiordiligi and Dorabella are actually their original fiancés in disguise.
And flipped. Yes, and flipped.
So he doesn't tell her that. So she's in on part of the plot, but not all of it. And she is, you know, a tremendously resourceful person who disguises herself as a doctor in the first act and as a notary in the second act. But ends up, of course, the joke is partly on her as well.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you'll have to go to the opera to see the rest of it. But this, so let's talk a little bit about the production. Mm-hmm. This is the 12th one, I think, since 1957 here at the Santa Fe Opera. The last one was in 2007.
Which was in a different production.
Right. Yeah. So talk about, you know, the evolution of how this opera has been performed and about this year's show.
Well, there are so many ways that you can do many operas, but particularly Così fan tutte, because it's not an opera that is at all dependent on its setting. It is, you know, supposed to be set in Italy, but it really doesn't matter. And these are characters who are quite universal, and they could live in any century. They could live today. I think they do live today. We probably all know people just like them. So that it offers us a great deal of flexibility in staging. And as a matter of fact, the director of the production, R.B. Schlatter, who is a rising young director, very interesting young guy who has a vast background in visual arts, to the point where he has called his productions installations rather than productions. He's done a lot
of... Oh, my goodness.
Yes, he's done a lot of productions in non-traditional spaces like art galleries and so on. And this particular production of Così that he's doing is very influenced by contemporary visual arts, and particularly of this part of the world, so that he's kind of placing it in our own milieu in a timeless way. The clothes that we'll see on the characters will be kind of non-specific, but some of the silhouettes will evoke 18th century garb. So what he's getting at here is the timeless, universal, and basically mythological roots of this piece. Although it doesn't have direct source material like the other Mozart da Ponte operas do, Figaro and Don Giovanni, it actually harkens back to ancient myths. You can find stories like this about testing the fidelity of lovers and switching partners. You can find them in all kinds of mythology, in Ovid's Metamorphoses, in the Decameron of Boccaccio, in Cervantes, in Shakespeare, and so on. And so this is what RB is getting at here.
Very interesting. So Così fan tutte by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Let's talk about the Pearl Fishers. Mm-hmm. That's another opera, a great classic with music that will just break your heart. And this is a French opera by composer Georges Bizet with libretto by, and you will pronounce them,
Michel Carré and Eugène Carmont.
So this is an opera that premiered in the 1800s, 1863. Mm-hmm. Bizet was a young man, 25 years old,
yep,
when it premiered. And this is, it's so interesting. I was reading that the original score was lost. So what do we know about, like, the productions that we're doing? What are they based on?
Mm-hmm. Well, the current production, and most of them nowadays, is based on a score that finally there is a critical edition of the score of the Pearl Fishers. Enough bits and pieces were found that scholars could put together something pretty authoritative.
Okay.
So what we're doing here is pretty echt. Bizet would recognize it.
Yeah.
But for many years, you know, a lot of times in the days before copyright, plays and operas were performed. You know, if somebody saw a play or an opera that they liked, they'd sort of crib it and take it to another city or another country and kind of reassemble it as they remembered it and so on. And a lot of corruptions crept in.
Right, right.
But this is actually as close as we can get to what Bizet actually wrote and intended. And he was 25, but it's not Juvenilia, because it's already his seventh opera.
Right.
And though Carmen, you know, his great masterpiece and the opera that he's most known for, is still 10 years in the future. And he, like Mozart, died very young. He died right after Carmen.
Right.
But it's a really great piece. The music, as you said, is just meltingly gorgeous.
Yeah.
It is absolutely beautiful.
The theme, I mean, if Così fan tutte was a love quadrilateral, this is a love triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And very much of a, what somebody might now call a bromance. I mean, these mm-hmm. two men who are really profoundly good and loving friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, the hit tune of this, the one that people will probably recognize, is the duet Au Fond du Temple Saint, which is a buddy duet,
yeah,
not a love duet between a tenor and a soprano or something like that. But it's about a friendship that once in the past was threatened by a woman that they both fell in love with. And lo and behold, after they swear friendship in the first act in this duet, the same woman happens into their lives again, quite by chance, and the triangle is renewed.
With potentially deadly consequences.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
This is one where I don't think, I mean, not that you can't find the plot anywhere, but it's one that I think, and again, the question of how you take in opera is such an interesting one, because a lot of people, they know the plot before mm-hmm. they go, they know everything. Some people have read the libretto in mm-hmm. the original language. Some people are going for the first time and are reading the supertitles on the chair.
Mm-hmm.
But the question of, do you allow yourself to be really caught up in the drama
mm-hmm.
as opposed to sort of seeing it from a more kind of aesthetic, intellectual distance? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think this is one of these operas that the music just sweeps you so viscerally and so emotionally into the opera that you almost can't have an intellectual approach to it. It just sweeps you away like a tidal wave. So, yeah, I think this is one of those operas where the emotional impact is the greatest takeaway.
It's set in Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka. And talk about exotic locations as the settings for opera.
Well, in the 19th century, Europeans, and particularly the French, were obsessed with what they called the Orient. And mind you, the Orient could be anything that wasn't France. I mean, even Spain, where Carmen is set, was considered to be really exotic. Bizet never went there, even though it was right next door to France.
Right.
As a matter of fact, one of the interesting things is that Pearl Fishers was originally intended to be set in Mexico. So it just,
another exotic location.
Yeah, it just goes to show you, one of the big reasons for this is because of Napoleon's conquest of Egypt and all of the antiquities that were coming out of there. It just really piqued Europeans' fascination with all things, quote-unquote, Oriental. So this is one of a huge stream of works of art, including paintings, plays, operas, novels that have to do with this orient of the mind, really, because very few of these people actually went there and experienced it.
And it's the kind of thing where if you were judging a work of art by today's standards, they'd never get away with it, because
no,
it'd be considered
it's not,
a kind of...
it's not ethnography. It's not intended to be.
No, but I mean, it's a kind of... well, people now might put sort of colonialist labels on it or something.
Oh, yeah,
like that.
Definitely. But again, going back to what we were talking about before, we have to look at all of these works through the lens of when they were created and understand them from that standpoint. And we don't just throw them away because they represent a certain outmoded viewpoints. We find ways to tease out what is relevant, what remains relevant, what remains universal about them. And great works of art always have that.
And also, in those so-called outmoded viewpoints, our own viewpoint will soon be outmoded.
Oh, yeah.
And something else will come to take its place. Mm-hmm. And every one of those perspectives came from a deep place. It wasn't like people were trying to be buttheads or something.
Exactly. That's a really great observation.
So what do you think that Orientalism was all about?
Well, it was a fascination with the other. I don't know if you know Edward Said's writings about the East and the West. You know, he articulates that image of the other, the person who is unlike you. And for Europeans, that meant that the people in the Orient were more emotional and more subjective and more romantic, you know, whereas the Westerners were supposed to be much more rational and buttoned up and so on. And there was a kind of envy, I think. It was sort of a twin envy of that freedom, and also it was a little bit suspect as well.
You see that in German literature with their attitude toward the Italians, which were supposed to be free. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, you were just talking about the Enlightenment rationalism and the succeeding Romanticism. Mm-hmm. So this is a kind of polarity that plays out over and over again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For instance, in a piece like Prince Igor, the opera by Borodin, you know, he's got the Russians and the Polovtsians, who are an Eastern, you know, a Central Asian tribe. You know, for us, Russians are plenty exotic in the 19th century, but this is a story about where the Polovtsians are really exotic to the Russians.
Right.
So it's all relative.
Now, this opera was first produced here in Santa Fe, at the Santa Fe Opera in 2012. Mm-hmm. Talk about the current production.
That's this production. You know, so the first time that the Pearl Fishers was done in Santa Fe was in 2012, and this is a revival of that production. And as a matter of fact, it's the only actual revival in the present season. All the other productions are brand new. But we decided to bring this one back because it's really good, and we have a great cast for it.
People can look forward to seeing that. I remember seeing it 7 years ago, and it was indeed beautiful. This is an opera, and this is something that I also wanted to talk to you about. There are operas that are loved the moment they come out. Mm-hmm. This wasn't quite one of those.
Well, it didn't... That's an interesting question. Compared to Bizet's earlier operas, it was much more successful. It was the thing that really got his operatic career kind of going more. And actually, ironically, it was much more immediately successful than Carmen was.
Oh, interesting.
Because people, like a lot of people, thought Carmen was too difficult and complicated, and they accused it of being Wagnerian and things like that.
And now everybody sings it.
Yeah, in the shower.
Right.
Right, yeah. We think of it as a chestnut. Yeah.
Very interesting. So the Pearl Fishers here at the Santa Fe Opera, which is, by the way, where we are recording today. The next opera that we want to talk about is La Bohème, another classic Giacomo Puccini, libretto by
Luigi Illica and Giuseppe Giacosa.
Thank you. And this is an opera that premiered in 1896. And unlike, for example, Così fan tutte, which you have to do a lot of suspension of disbelief, this feels so real.
Mm-hmm, it does. Yes, Bohème, well, first of all, it comes from a period and a genre known as Verismo in Italian opera, which literally means realism. And this was bouncing off contemporary trends in the theater where the storylines were going from ancient sagas of kings and knights and princes and so on into the stories of people's everyday lives. It was a move towards embracing the common person by the arts.
And you forget that that was something that had to be invented.
Yes, because it really didn't exist before that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was kind of on the cutting edge when it first came out. And again, now we think of it as a chestnut. You might say it's Puccini's earliest blockbuster. Immediately before it was Manon Lescaut, which is the first of his operas that's commonly performed. But this is, you know, one of the blockbusters, along with Tosca and Butterfly and Turandot. And yeah, and many people feel that in some way it harks back to Puccini's own youth.
Talk about that.
Well, you know, he was a rather impoverished student in Milan. And so he knew these people, he knew these characters in Bohème who were struggling along, trying to be artists in the big city.
And really down to their last penny.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you can find letters from Puccini to his mother, you know, talking about how he's surviving on minestrone soup because he spent his last penny taking some woman out to dinner or something.
So talk about, what are the origins of this story? Was it based on a novel?
It's based on a book called Scènes de la vie bohème by Henri Murger. It was written in the 1860s, and it's a thinly veiled autobiography of Murger himself, who during the 1830s and 40s was a bohemian in Paris.
Right.
So it's kind of a recollection. It's sort of, it's not a novel per se, but he originally published these as individual stories in a magazine and then compiled them. So as a novel, it's quite episodic. And actually the opera follows that sort of episodic quality.
Now, when it came out in 1896 as an opera, did it feel like, you know, retro in certain ways, like we're looking back at what Paris was like in the 1830s?
No, because Puccini and his librettists really kind of bumped it up to be contemporary to their era.
Okay.
But very interestingly, our director here, Mary Birnbaum, is setting it in the 1830s.
Interesting.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that, it's a really fascinating idea. Going right back to the source.
So it's a totally new production from the last La Bohème here in Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm. And also, since it is being directed by a female director, Mary Birnbaum, she really is particularly highlighting the female characters, Musetta and Mimi, and their trajectory. You know, she feels that in many productions of Bohème, the male characters dominate. And she feels that the stories of the two female protagonists are every bit as important and is sort of weighting her production that way.
Maybe I'm biased because of my own gender, but I've always sort of thought of it as a story of those two.
Well, me too, but, you know, obviously a lot of other male directors haven't. So Mary is trying to, you know, re-tip that balance.
And those two characters, talk about them a little bit, Mimi and Musetta, very, very much a study in contrast. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want to, like, you know, introvert and extrovert or whatever, but, mm-hmm. you know, one just a lovely, sweet, quiet, and the other kind of a go-getter.
Right, a spitfire. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's certainly true, and that's part of what makes the contrast between them is so delightful, and of course they turn out to be good friends. But also, Mary did a lot of research into Paris during this period, and particularly the Bohemian quarter of Paris. And Mimi and Musetta represent two different types of females that you could find during that era. Mimi is a grisette, and the grisettes were usually sort of blue-collar, you know, they would be seamstresses or shop girls or something like that. Rather impoverished, and they would attach themselves to young men who were usually students or entry-level workers who would then move on.
Meaning they would...
The men would move on.
They would sort of abandon the
yes.
those women and go to
right.
women more of their own.
Exactly. Ilk. And then the grisette would find a new boyfriend,
right.
you know. So Mimi represents that. And Musetta, on the other hand, is what's known as a lorette, who's a slightly different animal. And the lorettes hung around in very artsy circles, not necessarily students, but they often, somebody like Georges Sand, who sometimes would dress in male garb, very free-spirited and outspoken. And in this production, Musetta is a singer, because of course she is employed as a singer when we find her in Act 3 working at that tavern.
Right. And meanwhile, they're moving, at least Musetta, I mean, all of them to a greater or lesser extent, in the circles of wealthy counts and mm-hmm. people with money, and just almost like, not quite, but, you know, picking up the coins they drop. Because
exactly.
these people have so much power and in so many ways are unaware of how much these fun, young, you know, ladies and gentlemen that they're hanging out with mm-hmm. are poor as dirt.
Yeah. Absolutely. Another interesting thing about Mary's production, though, is that she took very much to heart the fact that Murger, the author of the source material, eventually became really bourgeois. Basically, he got rich from Scène de la Vie Bohème. Yeah, and
it's sort of interesting.
He became very bourgeois.
Yeah.
And he writes about that in Scène de la Vie de Bohème, where a couple of the characters towards the end are reminiscing about their bohemian youth and saying, oh, don't remind me of that because now I like to drink good wine and, you know, so on.
Maybe so, like a rapper who uh-huh. became famous.
Exactly.
Singing about the streets.
Exactly, exactly. So Mary is also showing a trajectory from the beginning to the end of the opera, which shows the bohemian sort of moving more, you know, sort of slightly, gradually more towards a quote-unquote grown-up kind of status, ready to accept more responsibility and facing the harsh realities of life, illness, and death.
Very, very interesting. Now, this is the 12th production of La Bohème here at the Santa Fe Opera. The first one was in 1958.
Well, it's actually, not to be pedantic about it, but it's the 12th time the opera has been in our repertory.
Right.
But there haven't been that many different productions.
Okay. So
yeah.
Some of them have been revivals
exactly.
of previous productions.
Yeah.
But it's been performed
right.
12 times.
Same with Cosy. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And one of the things that's interesting about this production is it seems to be majority people of color in the lead roles.
Yeah. Now that's something we're all really grooving on, because it happened by accident. You know, it's nobody, you know, we didn't have some like diversity committee here saying let's cast, you know, an all minority Bohème. But what happened is we just cast the best people for the roles. And two of them happened to be African American, and three of them happened to be Latino, and one of them happened to be Jewish. So there you go. And the guy who plays the bourgeois grown-up is a white dude.
Very interesting.
And it happened quite by happenstance.
Yeah.
But it really is bringing such an amazing, you know, layer to this production. It really is.
I love that it happened by coincidence, not by coincidence, but by casting the best people for
yeah.
the role. And that's
how it. That's what we do.
So that is La Bohème, and will be sure to be very popular at the opera this summer. The next two operas that we want to talk about have never been performed here in Santa Fe before. Mm-hmm. One of them is called Janufa, and it is a Czech opera by Leoš Janáček. And the composer also composed the libretto. Mm-hmm. And
based on a play by a very great Czech playwright, Gabriela Prajsová.
Right. And it's a rough story.
Oh, it is. It really is.
Tell us the story.
And it's, you know, here we are going chronologically, as you are. We're kind of creeping into the 20th century where things are getting darker. And not that, frankly, I think Cozy is in its own way just as dark, although it's so funny, as some of these 20th and 21st century things. But Janufa is a story that is originally set in a small Moravian village in probably the 19th century. And it's a story about a young woman, the title character, who stands out in her village because she's educated. She can read and write, and she teaches others to read and write. So right away we know she's somebody special. She has a stepmother, the Kostelnička, who is the sacristan of the church, so she's very respectable. She's a widow and very concerned with appearances and so on.
She's a widow, meaning Janufa's father died.
Exactly. She was married to Janufa's father. So, and Janufa is engaged to a young man named Steva, whose half-brother, Laca, is also in love with Janufa. Now, Steva is handsome and popular, and he's a real party boy. And Laca is a more sort of solid citizen, maybe not as charismatic, but a much more faithful, serious guy.
And of course, Janufa likes the guy who's
right.
The party boy.
Right, right, exactly.
Probably has a motorcycle.
Right, probably. And in this, we find out that she's actually pregnant by Steva. But Steva comes home roaring drunk, and the Kostelnička says to him, well, you can't marry Janufa for another year until you get your act together and sober up. He's supposed to be drafted into the army, but luckily for him, he isn't. But they put off the wedding. Now, that's, of course, very bad for Janufa because she's pregnant.
Right.
And Laca offers to marry her, but she says, you know, no, she's in love with Steva. It makes Laca so angry that he slashes Janufa's face with a knife and disfigures her face.
Saying, he only loved you for your rosy cheeks.
That's right. That's right. And he turns out to be right.
Yeah.
Because in the second act, when we find Janufa is in hiding in the Kostelnička's house, the Kostelnička has told everybody in the town that Janufa has gone away when she's been in hiding and given birth to this baby boy. Nobody knows about it. So Steva comes in and says, well, I will support this boy. I'll give you money, but nobody can know that it's mine. So let's just keep it under wraps. You know, and I'm not going to marry Janufa because she doesn't look beautiful anymore. So once again, Laca offers to marry her. And the Kostelnička, in utter desperation, because again, she is so concerned about appearances, and she's also really concerned about her stepdaughter's welfare, because in those days, if you were an unwed mother, things were not going to be good for you. So while Janufa is sleeping, she's given her a sleeping potion, the Kostelnička goes out in the winter, in the dead of winter, and throws the baby in an icy stream, which is really, really serious stuff.
Right.
And then finally, at the end of Act Two, Janufa, having learned of the death of her child, Kostelnička tells Janufa when she awakens that the baby died while she was asleep. And finally, at the end of that act, Janufa does decide to marry Laca. So the beginning of the third act finds the preparations for the wedding of Janufa and Laca. the village is all happy, and it's kind of one of the, you know, the only really upbeat scenes in this, when all of a sudden the body of a baby washes up from the stream, which is melting because it's the spring. And of course, that really, you know, puts a damper on everything. And first, of course, everybody accuses Yennefer, because they figure it must have been her. And at that moment, the Kostelnička confesses.
And they haul her off to jail.
They haul her off to jail.
The
and,
end.
Yeah, and so that she's a very fascinating, complex character, because, yeah. You know, you think she's so awful, you know, she does such horrible things for wrong reasons and right reasons, but in the end, she can't let Yennefer take the rap, and she wants her to have what she can of a happy life. So then at the very end, we're alone with Yennefer and Latza, and she says to him, well, now you can't marry me. There's such disgrace on my family. And he says, no, I still want to marry you. I love you. And so this opera of this gritty realism and all these horribly difficult and poignant situation ends with this incredible ray of hope that through all of this, that forgiveness and hope and so on, and there's this transcendent music with which it ends, which is quite an incredible piece. It really is. It's Janáček's first fully mature opera. And by mature, he was 50 years old when he wrote it, but he had written a few operas previously. This is when he hit his stride as an opera composer.
So this opera premiered in 1904, and so here we are just over 100 years later. Mm-hmm. And first of all, how was it chosen for the Santa Fe Opera, and what are some of the challenges? I mean, I would think singing in Czech language.
Yes, and we have a native-born Czech person on our music staff, Miloš Repičky, who is a lovely guy, and he's guiding us through the thickets of the Czech language.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's that. Although now that Janáček's operas have begun to really be embraced in the standard repertory, Czech has become more of a common language in the opera house than it was 10 or 20 years ago.
Do people learn, like, do the singers learn kind of basic Czech grammar kind of thing?
Well, I think, the first and foremost thing is they learn how to pronounce everything, and they learn the literal translations of what they're saying, word-by-word translations.
Right.
And from that, they can put together the grammar a little bit. But I think the most conscientious among singers really do try to actually study the languages in which they're singing.
So tell us a little bit about the production. Is it set in the present or in...
Well, this is by a very fascinating director, David Alden, who has been here a number of times before, a very experienced director. And he takes this opera and sets it in the 20th century, the late, middle to late 20th century, in an Eastern Europe industrial town.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah. So he takes it out of that sort of rural setting and puts it into a sort of bleak communist,
right,
you know, setting, which kind of really brings out the bleakness in the story.
That's such a great idea.
Yeah, it is. It really is a wonderful production.
The last production we want to talk about today is The 13th Child, and that is a world premiere here at the Santa Fe Opera on the 27th of July. There's four performances throughout the summer, music by Paul Reuters and libretto by Becky and David Starobin.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this opera, how the whole thing came into being.
Yeah.
The music, the lyrics. I think the libretto came first, is that right?
Well, it always does.
Libretto, does it always?
Yes. Always, libretto always has to be written first, and then the music is sort of applied on top of the libretto, if you will. So this is, Paul Reuters is a wonderful opera composer. This is his fifth opera. His most popular opera is an opera of The Handmaid's Tale, which he wrote actually before it became like a blockbuster movie and TV series.
Right.
But of course, it was already the very well-known dystopian novel by Margaret Atwood, Canadian author. So this is his fifth opera, and he wanted to do something really different. So he and Becky and David came up with the idea of a fairy tale. And by the way, one of the most fascinating things about The 13th Child is that it wasn't actually commissioned, as most things are. This grew out of a long-time deep friendship and artistic partnership between the Starobins and Paul Reuters. They met years and years, like decades ago, when they were all young artists. And David, of course, is a world-famous guitarist. And he and his wife, Becky, run Bridge Records, which is a very distinguished recording company of classical music.
Right.
And so Paul has written multiple guitar pieces for David to play. David has conducted some of Paul's music. Bridge Records records Paul's music. And so it's a big happy family for a long time. And they just decided, you know, they decided, okay, Paul, time for you to write a new opera. No, how about a fairy tale? But Paul, being of a very sort of dark sensibility, I mean, thing is, he's this delightful Danish gentleman with a twinkle in his eye and a wry sense of humor, but he does have a very sort of, he loves the macabre, let's put it that way. And he came up with this fairy tale by the brothers Grimm, whose works are, in fact, grim, usually. And it's this tale called The Twelve Brothers. And it's a very ancient mythological prototype. And as a matter of fact, there are two other tales by Grimm that cover the same plot, really. Different versions of the same plot. And there's also one by Hans Christian Andersen. And many, many other versions and coming from different cultures, you know. But it's about a king who has 12 sons and, you know, starts to feel paranoid that they're going to overthrow him. So he says to his queen, that who is pregnant, that this next child better be a daughter. And if it's not, we're going to exile, you know, I'm going to kill the boys. I'm going to kill all the boys. So the queen sends the boys into hiding, and they all live in a forest, you know.
Which happens so often in those fairy tales.
It's I know.
Royalty's banished.
Exactly, exactly. So the king goes mad and eventually dies. And then in the second act, we meet the young daughter, Lyra, and who asks, she happens upon, in the castle, the palace, she happens upon a cabinet where she finds 12 shirts, of male shirts of various sizes. And she says to her mother, what's this all about? And the mother tells her the story of what happens and says to her, you know, I'm going to die any day, but I want you to go and find your brothers. And she does. So one of the things I love about this is that, you know, there are so many quest stories in mythology. Here's a quest where the quester is a woman.
Right.
And it's great. It's really a wonderful story.
And there's people turning into ravens and turning back into people and so on. Now, what was your work like? I mean, you're the dramaturg and with new productions, I would think that you would be very busy.
Well,
tell us what you did on this.
Well, usually, you know, when we are developing new works, I work very closely with the composers and librettists developing the new works. This particular work came to us as a finished product.
Okay.
Therefore, what I've been doing is offering support to Becky and David and Paul in messaging. I'm going to be offering support in the process of staging and putting on the production. So that's what I'm doing here, and I'm at this point engaged in the nitty-gritty of developing further pieces that we've commissioned down the line.
Very interesting. So it's time to wrap up. We've talked about all five operas. There's so much more to talk about, but people can find out about things like the pre-opera dinners and lectures, which are wonderful events at the Santa Fe Opera, and a lot of people go tailgating, and I've done that, and people bring tables with tablecloths and flower vases and stuff. It's really super fun. There are family nights where the tickets are reduced prices. There are youth nights. There are backstage tours. There's transportation to get to the opera. All of this can be found out at santafeopera.org.
We just want to make everything as easy and fun for our patrons as we can.
Corey Ellison is dramaturg for the Santa Fe Opera. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was really fun.
And before we go today, we're going to play for you that famous and beautiful duet from The Pearl Fishers. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlffoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanlff Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.